Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less, guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
Anxiety is rising for America's youth, but at a faster rate among girls than boys. That's according to psychologist Lisa Damore. She has a new book out titled Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. And I had a chance to sit down and chat with Dr. Damore, and one of the things I asked her was about the stigma regarding anxiety.
It's almost like it's not so much stigma. It's more sort of this sense of it being always bad, I think, is probably what has changed. That when I was in my training, more than two decades ago, what we understood, and actually what psychologists still understand, is that anxiety is a normal and healthy function. It sort of alerts us when something's not right. You know, if we're driving and there's a car swerving near us, we get anxious, and we should, because it makes us pay attention and adjust. There are times when anxiety grows out of control, and, you know, it's sort of an alarm system that is going off all the time as opposed to when it's supposed to. But what seems to have changed more than anything is that when I hear people talking about anxiety, they talk about it as though it's always a sign that something's not working properly. You know, so-and-so, she suffers from anxiety. Well, everybody has anxiety. What we're interested in is whether the anxiety is useful, giving us a good sense that something's amiss and alerting us to make a change, or whether it is an alarm that's ringing all the time and doesn't make sense.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg. Independent Women's Voice. She's also a Fox News contributor. She joins Fox News to talk about the hurdles that women have overcome.
Well, look, what's terrific about this, even what we're doing here, not so long ago, within my lifetime, women weren't considered able of delivering the news because their voices were not authoritative enough, right? Mm-hmm. Even just the perception of the power of women has shifted within two generations, effectively. So that's very exciting. But we're also looking here now at, of course, an economic renaissance, and that's one of the key points.
And Bruce continues.
Freedom for women across the world, freedom for everyone across the world's increased because poverty has gone down by double digits, right? You've got major frameworks of women being able to access more education, so the literacy gap has changed as well. Girls are more likely around the world because of the availability of food to not die of starvation or malnutrition. We've got poverty, while it's down, we've got a long way to go, but we see these trends, and they're linked to freedom. countries that are based in freedom, not based in totalitarianism or even theocratic frameworks, where women in particular are removed from society and marginalized.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the center.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump says it's hard to believe the tornado damage in
You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Sorry, there seemed to be a little snafu here. I'm here to tell you about the weather. And let's see what's happening. I know it's been colder than people are used to at this time of year. Frankly, I think it's very nice to see the snow that's still on the ground. And what's going to happen, it's not going to last long, however, because tonight it's going to be mostly cloudy and then patchy fog, low of about 25 degrees. By tomorrow, patchy fog in the morning and then sunny, high of about 48 degrees, so we can expect a lot of melting. By Saturday night, there's a 50% chance of rain and snow, mixed rain and snow. It'll get down to about 34 degrees, so it's going to depend on exactly how low the temperature is, whether it's rain and sleet, or snow. Unfortunately, Sunday, and there is the St. Patrick's Day parade in Clinton, but there's a 100% chance of rain, and then about a 60%. So Sunday, although the high is going to be about 50 degrees, the parade in Clinton, if not washed out, is probably going to be not as comfortable as we would like to see it. We would rather have a nice sunny day. And, of course, Monday is going to be the nice sunny day. It'll be a high of about 47 degrees. By Sunday night, there's a slight chance of rain and then mostly cloudy. But, again, not great as far as Sunday weather. Tomorrow should be nice, sunny, after kind of fog in the morning. So, program It's the Law. Sorry, I'm a little not exactly together today. I ended up going to a funeral, didn't think I was going to be back. And frankly, I'd like to spend a couple minutes talking about one of the giants in the law in the matrimonial field. John Finnerty was an amazing service today in Fort Lee for John, and many of us who have known him for many years. John was one of the giants in many ways. Not only was he highly respected, he was a certified matrimonial law attorney, and John was bright. I mean, you know, there are bright people, and John was just an incredibly bright guy. Interesting background. Not only did he, I think he may have, I'm not sure where he did his undergraduate work. I think it was Brown. I know that he then was a reporter, apparently started out as a crime reporter, and then, of course, went to law school. He graduated from my alma mater, Rutgers Law School in Newark, in 1972. And then he, that was, he did get a master's degree in political science from Brown University and had a BA in political science from Brown. And he graduated from Brown undergraduate in 1965, as I said, and then in 1968 he got an MA and then took a couple years and before he went to law school. But I've known John probably from about 1984. He practiced in Bergen County, so it's not somebody I had a lot of cases against. But he really, he was kind of the attorney's attorney. He litigated many cases in and also went up to the Supreme Court. He took some of the really precedent-setting cases to the Supreme Court, including Lepus, which is the case where everybody cites if there are changed circumstances that they think an agreement or a decision needs to be modified post-judgment. He was also awarded the Saul Tischler Award, which is recognizing a lifetime of contributions to the advancement of family law in New Jersey. And when John started out in the early 1970s, in some ways family law was at its infancy because the equitable distribution statute was passed in 1971, and that totally changed the practice of law. Prior to that time, in a divorce situation, the person who held title to property, it was his or her property. And what was recognized is that that was totally unfair. Marriage is a partnership, and you could have a situation, which was very common, where you would have the husband who owned the business in his name, wife worked alongside of him for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years or more. And then at the time of divorce, since the business was in his name, he was entitled to the business. Now, that, of course, in most cases would mean that he would have to pay alimony, but it was just an unfair system. And so when New Jersey passed equitable distribution, what that means is, don't mean to give everybody a little lecture, but many people, even to this day, don't understand it. And that makes sense to me because I was just talking to someone, a father of one of my clients, and he was concerned that my client would have to pay off her husband or, you know, pay him or would have to pay him something else because she had some jewelry that she had received from her grandmother. And also the father, her father had given her a painting. Actually, it was a poster, and the husband was making claims that this was an extremely expensive painting. My client's father assured me that it wasn't. It wasn't an original. It was a poster. But in any event, what I was able to tell him, to reassure him, is that the ring my client received from her grandmother as a gift, and the painting poster that she received from her father were not subject to equitable distribution. She would not have to pay her husband. We would not have to get them appraised. All we had to do is prove the source. In other words, if we could prove that the ring came from her grandmother as a gift, the painting came to her from her father, that's all we had to prove. So that where the husband was claiming that the jewelry and the painting were worth approximately $200,000, she was not going to have to offset that and give her husband $100,000 additional value in the house or something else. So this is still something that is not understood. So once again, in New Jersey, from the date of the marriage to the date a complaint for divorce is filed, unless parties agree on another end date, all of the assets acquired during the marriage are subject to equitable distribution, except gifts from third parties and inheritances. So that is clear cut in New Jersey, and but people still don't understand. And sometimes I have someone who says, well, wait a minute, that's my pension. I worked during the marriage. It's my pension. Well, true, but in New Jersey, the idea is that marriage is a partnership and that the assets acquired during the marriage will be divided equitably. Does not mean equally, equitably. And for most part, except for businesses, it really does come down to 50-50. Now, someone will say to me, but I'm not going to get my pension until I retire. Why should I have to give my wife something to offset the pension? Well, a person doesn't, because there are two ways of dividing a pension. One is to do a current offset against another asset, but most of the time what we do is there is a special order that enables each party to get their share at the time the pension starts to be paid out. And it's called a QDRO, Quadro, a Qualified Domestic Relations Order, at least if it's a private plan from a private company. It's and the reason for that is this is, in fact, regulated by the federal government, and there are special regulations under ERISA where a former spouse can, in fact, get paid out, where creditors and other people can't touch someone's pension. So didn't mean to start and go on and on about that, but as I'm saying, John Finnerty was just a leader in thinking about policy. He was also one of the principal drafters of the revision to the New Jersey alimony statute that was adopted effective in September of 2014. He served on many committees. He was a chairman of the New Jersey State Bar Family Law Section from 1993 to 1994. Unbelievable to me it was that long ago. But he was also, he served for years with me on the New Jersey Supreme Court Family Part Practice Committee. And he was chair of that committee, subcommittee on custody and parenting for a number of years. As I said, I also served on that committee for many years. I was a vice chair and of the committee and served on other committees. And that kind of leads me into what's happening and why that committee is so important. So as soon as I play a couple spots, I'm going to come back and talk to you about law in New Jersey, not just family law, but how important the Supreme Court committees are and how we should support all of their work. And I'll tell you how things change in New Jersey procedurally because we're so far ahead of other states in cooperation between the bench and the bar. So let me figure out where my list is. Yes, I found it. So let me play a couple commercials, and then I'll come back, and we'll talk more about the rules.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on 100 in Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@100-chamber.org.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
100 Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, 100inchamberradio.com. Brought to you by the 100in County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para-planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Pat and Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Pat and Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@100-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Hi, I'm back. I'm Pat Smiths. Not sure I introduced myself today. As I mentioned, I had gone to a funeral, didn't think I was going to get back. John Finnerty, just giant in the legal world, and of course I served with him for many years on the New Jersey Family Practice Committee. And I think we sometimes forget all of the work that's done behind the scenes. And I think this was extremely important. The New Jersey Supreme Court Family, it's actually Family Part Practice Committee, is one of a number of committees do yeoman work and submit reports every other year to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court invites written comments on the reports. And there may be other reports that are done other years. I just know that this year the six committees whose reports were published this year, and I think that's what happens. It's every other year. The Supreme Court gets reports every year, but it's the committee. It's a two-year cycle. And so this year, they will all be published. They were published, and then there is a opportunity for anyone to respond. In other words, as long as the response is not anonymous, anybody is able to respond, not just attorneys. But this year, the committee's Committee on Complementary Dispute Resolution, or CDR, was one of the committees that reported. I was on that committee for a number of years, and CDR is Alternative Dispute Resolution. In other words, in New Jersey, we usually think of it as mediation falls under that committee, arbitration, collaborative law, and so that there is a specific committee dealing with issues with complementary dispute resolution, meaning that's not in the courts. Then there is a report from the Criminal Practice Committee, as I mentioned, one from the Family Practice Committee, a report from the Committee on Minority Concerns, and the Municipal Court Practice Committee, so that even all of the municipal courts, the rules and regulations, again, are generated by the Supreme Court. And then also the Committee on the Rules of Evidence. Now, this, of course, is something that attorneys are extremely concerned about, but most other people, don't really think that much about it because, if you're a litigant, you certainly don't need to know the rules of evidence except to the extent that your attorney would explain what may or may not be said and what documents may be introduced into evidence. So that what happens, we have a rule book. It is, inch and a half thick at least. All the rules, I have it in front of me. The 2019 edition has a blue cover. It's called Rules Governing the Courts of the State of New Jersey. And it contains all of the procedural issues. In fact, I'd like to give a shout out because someone near and dear to us here in Hunterdon County makes comments and annotations. This was done by Sylvia Pressler from 1969 through 2010 after Judge Pressler died. And even before that, Peter Verniero also worked with her. And now, I don't know who he has working with him, but Peter Verniero is the one who includes the comments and on all the specific rules. So what will happen is to explain the rules or where they're referred to, the comments talk about cases, they talk about applicability of certain things, they cross-reference to other rules. But this is more or less what I consider the lawyer's Bible. Now, we also have a book on rules of evidence, that's a separate book, really used mainly only when we're in court. May have to look at some of that is applicable in other, depositions and other things. But this, what I want to say, and I've said before, is we're so in the forefront here in New Jersey because when procedural issues need to be tweaked, the Supreme Court practice committees are the ones that look into and make recommendations to the Supreme Court, and then after the period of time for comments, the court, meaning the Supreme Court, either agrees and accepts it, the rule change or modification, or there perhaps is no change. For example, I'm looking at the report from this year. There was a on arbitration, for example. There is a rule with respect to arbitration. It's Rule 5:1-5, and it talks about the scope of the rules, for example. And this year there's been no change there is a arbitrator disclosure form, and that's a slight modification. So the arbitration/umpire disclosure form, which is set forth in the appendix to the rules, shall be signed by the arbitrator/umpire attached to the agreement or consent order and filed with the court. So that's a new modification. The arbitrator now has to sign this. And I think that might be the only change in arbitration for the new rule cycle. Now, the court could or wouldn't have to approve that. I'm assuming that the court will. And there was apparently some concerns that, you know, they wanted to be sure that the arbitrator does, you know, sign that disclosure form that is set forth in the rules, so that it would be uniform in every case. There's also some questions about family part summary actions. It's really not that significant. Some cases are considered summary actions. Actually, divorce cases are not summary actions. And there's also some technical amendments to correct an erroneous citation that happened, so that somehow when there was a, you know, typo or an erroneous citation, and there was in one of the rules pertaining to attorney withdrawal from representation, and this was simply the correct citation is to paragraph E rather than paragraph A9. So these are, you know, these are like anything else. We all read books, and there may be some errors in it. And what the court very carefully does is correct those errors in the next edition of the book. So there are also, I don't believe there were any changes as far as attorney's fees in civil actions. There is a proposed amendment to require the filing of a case information statement in family part as a financial statement. And the proposed amendment to the rule would require both parties to file an updated financial statement upon the application of the person who's paying alimony if there is an application to modify or terminate alimony based upon retirement. And what happened is there has been a change in the law. When I started practicing, I felt that it was very poorly worded, but we had what we called permanent alimony. And, you know, everybody thought that an alimony award, if it was a permanent alimony award, would be forever. And that really hurt everyone, because what happens when someone retires, if the supporting spouse retires and really can't pay alimony, that was a problem. And, of course, it's a problem for the recipient of alimony to think that there will never be a change. So this did change. So the question is, though, if someone files, and let's be traditional, if the ex-husband filed for a modification or reduction in alimony because he wanted to retire, he would have to show his financial circumstances, but there was no requirement on the first go-around that the former wife would have to show her financial situation and file a case information statement, which often simply meant that people were going to have to go to court twice, because the first time the former husband filed the motion, and, you know, former wife didn't file any information about her finances, the court would have to then order her to file a case information statement so that the court would have the finances of both parties. And that can be, you know, that could be significant. There's also when there's a motion, attachments for establishing alimony or child support. And so this, when a motion or cross motion is filed to establish alimony or child support, the pleadings filed in support of or in opposition to the motion shall include a copy of a current case information statement. So if anyone's seeking for child support, seeking alimony, both parties, the one who files and the one who responds, have to file a case information statement that's current. And then, again, as I said, if it's a modification for enforcement or motion of a prior order, in other words, if it's either enforcement of a prior order or modification of a prior order, the order or judgment has to be appended to the pleadings. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer, but apparently they feel that that needed to be put into the rules. And so the other motion, attachments for modification or termination of alimony or child support, not based on retirement. So that's when that motion or cross motion is filed for modification or termination of alimony or child support, other than an application based on retirement, then the person moving for this shall attach copies of his or her current case information statement and the case information statement previously executed or filed in connection with the order or judgment that they're looking to modify. So in other words, you have to show the change in the circumstances. And however, what this means is also if the court concludes that the party seeking relief has demonstrated a prima facie showing of a substantial change of circumstances or there is other good cause, then the court shall order the opposing party to file a copy of the current case information statement. So this means that you don't have to jump and file a current case information statement just because the other side filed a motion for modification or termination of alimony or child support. Important, because the fact is post-judgment litigation can get extremely expensive and time-consuming. And, of course, one of the things that we have to tell people is, you know, keep your old case information statement. I can't tell you the number of times that I will call a former or a former client will call me and, you know, I ask, you know, do they even have the agreement? No, they're calling me because they don't have a copy of their agreement. Do they have a copy of the judgment of divorce? Well, more often they will have that. Do they have a copy of the financial information they filed the last time? Nope. And, of course, that's required to be attached when there's any modification or termination. Now, I personally, over the years, always have kept copies of the parties' agreements so that when somebody calls me, I can more easily go look at it and answer their question. But now, I didn't always keep, at least not handy. And we have to keep files for 7 years, but after that, most attorneys just chuck them. I keep files longer because it's not unusual for some people to have very young children and things of importance come up more than 7 years later. But in any event, I now make sure that a copy of the case information statement is and the judgment of divorce, that I have three things. Judgment of divorce, case information statement, and agreement. And that way, if I will have at least the bare bones if a client needs to go back to court and can't find their copies. So, actually, you know, the rules are a little more specific now as far as requirement requirements. There's a new rule that I think is really foolish. There are page limits now, but now what their proposal is that everything in support of a motion not exceed a total of 25 pages, but that 25 pages would be allocated between the initial certification and the reply certifications as the person moving deems appropriate. So it seems to, where it used to be that the everything for in support of the motion would be 15 pages, and then there could be a reply certification not to exceed a total of 10 pages. What they're now saying is that the 25 pages, can be allocated as the attorney wants it to be. I have to look at that one a little more carefully because it would certainly be difficult for someone who's filing a motion to figure out how many pages they should save, I guess was the best word, save for the reply certification. They're also now under the prevention of domestic violence, the temporary restraining orders. There's an issue, and with respect to the temporary restraining orders, which is Rule 5:7A, and this is under number A, where it says, in court proceedings instituted under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act of 1990, the judge shall issue a temporary restraining order when the applicant appears to be in danger of domestic violence. The order may be issued ex parte when necessary to protect the life, health, or well-being of a victim on whose behalf relief is sought. Be right back after a couple commercials because somebody's ringing my cell phone.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Well, hi, I'm back. I don't know who was calling on my cell phone. I do realize that I forgot to turn it off. I frankly don't use the cell phone that often because I forget to turn it off when I'm in court, and the judges don't like that. So anyway, we're talking about some of the changes in the for filing domestic violence orders, domestic violence complaints. And so the issue now is this is specific. So in court proceedings instituted under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, that's the act where someone tries to get a restraining order, it seems to me that this is considered a higher standard, because the judge shall issue a temporary restraining order when the applicant appears to be in danger of domestic violence. So, and the order may be issued ex parte when necessary to protect the life, health, or well-being of a victim on whose behalf the relief is sought. That, you know, the judges seems to me they're going to have to make, you know, these are difficult decisions, and they're going to have to, in this case, you know, decide if the applicant appears to be in danger of domestic violence. So, in other words, if in a situation where, and I have to look at this more carefully, because does that mean that there's been no domestic violence and the alleged victim just appears to be in danger of it? I think that the judges and everyone is going to have to look carefully at the entire report to see why that provision was recommended and what does it really mean. One of the things that I didn't think had been changed, but it looks like it might have, the venue in domestic violence action shall be laid, meaning it goes in the county where either the parties reside, where either of the parties reside, in the county where the domestic violence offense took place, or in the county where the victim of domestic violence is sheltered. And then the final hearing is to be held in the county where the ex parte restraints were ordered, unless good cause is shown for the hearing to be held elsewhere. Well, certainly, although the domestic violence hearing could be in the county where the domestic violence offense took place, that makes sense. But where the victim of domestic violence is sheltered, very often that won't make sense because the victim doesn't want the perpetrator to know where he or she is sheltered. So, you know, except in certain circumstances, you know, there's some fairly significant additions into the domestic violence area. I'm going to have to really read those and look at the background to talk more about it. But, you know, these are very important. It's really important to protect victims of domestic violence. And it's also important that a DV complaint not be used to take advantage in a matrimonial case. And that happens often. It really does. It's unfortunate that it happens. But, you know, if somebody won't move out of the house, one way to get, and it's usually him, out of the house is to file for domestic violence. Now, it may be that it's just needed to get that filing to protect the victim. And it's unfortunate when it's used to get a leg up in a divorce case. So all of these new, you know, there are things like contemporaneously the judge shall issue a written confirmatory order and shall enter thereon the exact time of issuance of the duplicate order. If there is a duplicate order, you know, there's the judge has to direct law enforcement assisting the applicant to print the judge's name, and et cetera, et cetera. And the judge shall also contemporaneously record financial determinations. And this is important because on weekends and at night, someone who goes to the police department, they will call the municipal court judge. And so there really has to be exact standards as to how that should be handled, so it's handled uniformly. There's also another addition with respect to procedure if someone is arrested and for violating one of the, well, violating a restraining order. There's a number of changes with respect to sexual assault victims. And, you know, again, temporary protective orders. And a judge may issue a temporary protective order upon sworn oral testimony of an applicant who's not physically present. So that's pretty significant. In other words, they can do it as long as there is sworn testimony. And that could be, for example, over the phone. And so this is the Sexual Assault Survivor Protection Act and protective orders. There's some fairly new language in that particular order. Excuse me, in that particular rule. And the... just trying to see if there's anything else that... there's also some proposed amendments to comply with the Indian Child Welfare Act. Should talk about that Child Welfare Act at some point, because it really is very interesting. What happens is it's necessary, the act, the certain rule amendments were necessary to comply with the Indian Child Welfare Act, the ICWA, prior to authorizing the out-of-home placement of a child to a non-parent. And so the committee dealing with it recommended the amendments conform to the definition of an Indian child as set forth in 25 CFR 23-2. And the definition, really, this is very specific. A child who is a member of a federally recognized Indian tribe, or a child who is eligible to be a member of a federally recognized Indian tribe and is the biological child of a member of a federally recognized Indian tribe. So you're talking about a biological child of a member. So if one parent is... you know, if the child is eligible to be a member, the act protects that child. And then the committee also recommended amendments to clarify that an investigation is necessary only when the court cannot determine if the statute applies to a child. And so the amendment is that... says exactly that. A child who is a member of a federally recognized Indian tribe, or, that was number one. Number two, a child who is eligible for membership in a federally recognized Indian tribe and is the biological child of a member of a federally recognized Indian tribe. Now, it's interesting, and frankly, I don't know the answer with respect to whether a child is an adopted child, because this talks about a biological child of a member of a federally recognized Indian tribe. So I honestly don't know what ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, says about adopted children. I wouldn't imagine, in most cases, obviously, an adopted child cannot be treated any differently than a biological child. So it'll be interesting to see how they deal with that issue in the statute. And of course, if it's determined that a child is an Indian child, as defined by the statute, the requirement of the statute requirements, I should say, of the statute shall apply. There's another important that surrogacy has now been in New Jersey, the old, there was case law that did not allow surrogacy in the state of New Jersey. So that has been changed, and so then the committee considered whether amendments to the rule were necessary to conform to the New Jersey Gestational Carrier Agreement Act. So there's actually an act now in New Jersey, and the act provides an order of parentage may be obtained from the court prior to the birth of the child or immediately thereafter. The order directs the doctor or healthcare facility to include the names of the intended parents as the legal parents of the child on the birth certificate and not the name of the gestational carrier or her spouse or partner. And if all the terms, conditions, and requirements of the act are satisfied, the order of parentage shall be issued by the court. And the act does not require a notice of filing of the complaint establishing parentage on the Bureau of Vital Statistics.
Good afternoon, the Flemington.
Attorney General's office. The act actually provides for a less restrictive process to execute a relinquishment or surrender of parental rights. But it does, of course, require that and to be signed by the gestational carrier and if she has a spouse or partner by the spouse or partner. Now, this act, although prospective, meaning it's not going to be retroactive to cases in the past or situations in the past,
good afternoon, Hunterdon County. I'm Bill Wolfson, and this is the Sports Guy. And actually, today is just the Sport Guy because John Manfreda is still on our injured reserve list, and Patricia Garrity Smits, our sports gal, is down in the Dominican Republic learning how to be a better divorce lawyer than she already is. Meanwhile, I'm going to talk about sports. I'm going to talk about some of the things going on in the world of sports today and tonight and this weekend. And the first thing I want to talk about is a subject near and dear to my heart, the Stanley Cup playoffs. Our last New York related team, the New York Islanders or the Long Island Islanders, are skating tonight against Carolina in Game 4 of the Best of 7 Stanley Cup Conference Semifinal Series. The Islanders are down 3-0. The first two games were very exciting one-goal games, which the Islanders lost both at home. Now the Carolina Hurricanes are hosting them at 7 o'clock tonight. You can see the game on any of the NBC affiliates. And it's going to be exciting because desperation elimination games are always the most exciting hockey. I played hockey as a kid and as a young man, as a maybe not-so-young man, kind of foolishly. But the elimination games are the most fun, I think, because there's all the desperation and the chance to put the other team away. The Islanders were not favored to even get into the Stanley Cup playoffs back in October when the season began, but they solved their goaltending problems. They solved their scoring problems, even though they had lost John Tavares from Toronto. Now, Toronto has gone out of the Stanley Cup playoffs to Boston. So who to watch tonight? One of the best guys to watch is going to be a fellow by the name of Eberle. And Mr. Eberle, Jordan Eberle, is a forward. He is one of the better puck handlers. He's a finisher, which means that he has a lot of skill in hanging on to the puck and completing a play and getting a shot on net. The Islanders are very anxious about trying to bring this back to Long Island or to the Barclays Center for at least one more game, because in a year or two they're going to be leaving Barclays Center in Brooklyn and returning to a new arena out in Nassau County. They've played a number of games in their traditional arena, the Nassau Coliseum, which can only be described as a rat hole these days. It's not a particularly nice place to watch a game anymore. I've been there a couple of times, and it's an arena that had been around since the 70s and was outdated, and as you may know from watching hockey on TV,